This is VOA News reporting via remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that China and Russia both pose urgent military and technological threat to NATO. Following talks with NATO foreign ministers Wednesday in Brussels, Blinken said the two superpowers were willing to use aggressive non-military actions, including cyber attacks and disinformation, to threaten the shared values within NATO. NATO's mission in Afghanistan also featured high on the agenda during the two-day meeting, with U.S. troops set to withdraw by May 1st under a peace deal signed by the Trump administration and the Taliban in 2020. Blinken said the situation is under review and the U.S. would consult with NATO allies. North Korea conducted an apparent short-range ballistic missile test early Thursday, its first such launch during the Joe Biden administration. Japan's prime minister said the North fired two ballistic missiles that fell outside Japan's waters. This is North Korea's first ballistic missile test in about a year, although it has more recently fired smaller projectiles. The launches come as the Biden administration is in the final stages of its North Korea policy review and has repeatedly spoken of desire to renew diplomacy with the North. Pyongyang has said it is not interested in talks until the U.S. drops its hostile policy, a reference to sanctions, military exercises, and other U.S. activities on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea has boycotted talks for over a year and seems intent on ramping up pressure on Washington. By remote, this is VOA News. Facebook says hackers in China use fake accounts and imposter websites in a bid to break into the phones of Uyghur Muslims. The tech company said Wednesday that it uncovered the covert sophisticated hacking operation as part of its routine security work. It says the hackers created fake Facebook accounts and fake websites and apps intended to appeal to a Uyghur audience. The accounts and sites contain malicious links that would infect the victim's computer or smartphone with spyware. In all, fewer than 500 people were targeted among the Uyghur community in China, as well as in countries including the U.S. Facebook linked the hackers to two Chinese tech firms. Brazil topped 300,000 confirmed COVID-19 deaths on Wednesday, becoming the second country to do so amid a spike in infections, with record daily death tolls in recent days. The United States reached the grim milestone back on December 14th, but has a larger population than Brazil. President Jair Bolsonaro on Wednesday met with the heads of other government branches to coordinate antivirus efforts, but he didn't propose any policies to deal with the pandemic. U.S. President Joe Biden chose his Vice President Kamala Harris to lead the White House effort in tackling the immigration challenge at the southern border with Mexico. Harris is tasked with addressing the surge of young migrants at the border, a challenge that threatens the administration's legislative agenda. The president says she'll deal with the Northern Triangle nations of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras to tackle internal issues that drive immigration. The U.S. has seen a dramatic spike in border encounters over the past 2 months. The U.S. Senate has confirmed former Pennsylvania Health Secretary Rachel Levine to be the nation's Assistant Secretary of Health. She's the first openly transgender federal official to win Senate confirmation. She's expected to oversee the Health and Human Services offices and programs across the U.S. Transgender rights activists have hailed Levine's appointment as a historic big breakthrough. And the Olympic torch relay will start in Fukushima on Thursday, kick off a four-month countdown to the Summer Games in Tokyo, delayed from 2020 and the first ever organized during a global pandemic. 10,000 runners would take the torch starting from the site near the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami that killed 20,000 people. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Thursday, March 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Congo Republic president wins 88% of the vote as the opposition considers challenging the results.
How anybody within the country can go and appeal to the results of the presidential election when the body that you're supposed to go and appeal to is basically, at the end of the day, controlled by the president.
WFP warns it may cut food ration in June for more than a million Somalis due to lack of funds. Zimbabwe musicians find alternative ways to earn a living amid COVID-19 pandemic. And Burundi welcomes Rwanda's decision to shut down exiled Burundian media institutions.
What Rwanda has done in shutting down those rather bizarre medias falls within the logic of not allowing harmful elements to exist on its territory.
And Botswana opens hunting season with 287 elephants on offer. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Brazzaville President Denis Sassou Nguesso, as suspected, won 88% of last Sunday's presidential vote. Nguesso has been in power for 36 years. However, opposition candidate Matias Zorn, who came third, is considering challenging the results in the country's constitutional court because he says the vote was rigged. Telama Hove Miabe is professor of mathematics at the University of the District of Columbia. He is also coordinator of the National Congress for Democracy of Congo-Brazzaville. He says contesting the results will be a futile exercise because President Denis Sassou Nguesso controls all institutions in Congo-Brazzaville.
I respect Mr. Ndjian, and I understand that he's living in the country where he's not really free. I think when we think about Congo-Brazzaville, that is one of the elements that we need to take in consideration, that Congo is not a democracy. Mr. Sassou Nguesso is not a democrat. He's a dictator. And the reality is that dictators do not organize free and fair elections. And so when you're a dictator, you are basically the legislative, the judiciary, and the executive. He holds all those three branches of government. So how, when you hold those three branches of government, how anybody within the country can go and appeal to the result of the presidential election when the body that you're supposed to go and appeal to is basically, at the end of the day, controlled by the president, who's the executive? So as Mr. Nzong is actually trying to do the same thing Patrick Kolela did in 2016 when he went to the court, tried to basically appeal, but nothing is going to happen. Sassou Nguesso will remain president unless the people come out of the street and remove through protest out of power.
How independent do you think is the constitutional court in Congo-Brazzaville?
As I said to you, Congo-Brazzaville is a dictatorship. In the dictatorship, the people who are in power, they control all branches of government, all three branches of government, even the media. So when you're talking about going to the judiciary to go to court, the courts are into an oppressive system of government. How are you going to appeal to a court, to a judge, who knows that if he doesn't side the right way, his life is in danger? So at that moment, we have to consider that the court itself is compromised. The legislative is also compromised. And so going to the court, claiming to go to the court, is just a statement to express frustration. Mr. Ndjian is smart enough to understand and know that no matter what court he goes into Congo, nothing is going to happen.
Opposition candidate Guy Brice Parfait Kolelas, who died before the vote was taken, his party is also claiming that the election was fraudulent.
First of all, I just want to express my deepest sadness to have a friend of mine. He's a big brother of mine that just died. He was fighting a true fight. Some people doubted him. However, it's a sad day for Congo-Brazzaville. Now, they're telling us it's COVID. It's normal and absolutely understandable that many of us, myself included, will question the thesis or the statement that it's really the COVID that has killed Miss Parfait Kolelas. So right now, his body is actually in France. There's an autopsy that is taking place, and we are hoping that there will not be any interference of any power within the French government so that we can really determine what is the true reasons, the true causes of death for Mr. Parfait Kolelas. I think by tomorrow, we should have an official statement from either the family or the people that are in charge. I am talking to the family members, so we are waiting to receive the outcome.
Telama Hervé Miabe is professor of mathematics at the University of the District of Columbia. He is also coordinator of the National Congress for Democracy of Congo-Brazzaville. You are speaking with us from Washington, D.C. After an attack over the weekend in western Niger left 137 people, many of them already displaced, dead, the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, called on warring parties in the Sahel to protect civilians. A spokesperson for UNHCR's West and Central Africa office, Romain Desclos, spoke to Ricky Stryak about how the attack worsened the already dire situation for the region's refugees.
This is a tragic situation. Many of them were already displaced. They had fled violence within the country and had sought refuge a bit further, somewhere where they thought they would be safe from attacking armed groups. The situation is tragic also, not only for those forced to flee, but for the communities that are hosting them. The civilian population, whether they are displaced or hosting people forced to flee, are bearing the brunt of armed attacks in the region. The past few days and week, several attacks took place in the nearby Tillaberi region, an attack that targeted people as they were coming back from a market, the biggest market in that region, which means people's ability to have a livelihood is also affected. So not only are they fearing for their lives, but their capacity to get by, survive, is also tragically affected. What we need also to pay attention to is the extraordinary generosity of Nigerian people, because despite facing insecurity themselves, they still welcome many who are forced to flee, whether they are Nigerians themselves displaced by the violence or refugees from nearby Mali. The regions of Tawa and Tillaberi at the moment are hosting over 200,000 people forced to flee, whether refugees or internally displaced.
An attack such as this, what kind of effect will it have on the daily lives of people, of children, women, families?
This attack has undoubtedly many effects. We don't know yet how many people are fleeing from that attack, but we foresee that several, if not many, will move towards another place, start their lives again, having to find a place to call a home, a shelter, place to heat, having something to eat, having an income if they can feed their family, but also for children, having a chance to go to school again. Many children, since the conflict has started, have missed out on education, and that's one of the biggest challenges we're facing in the region, not just in Niger, but also in the whole Sahel. It also means, and Intikan is a key example of what's happening. Last May, armed groups also attacked Intikan, that region, that area near Tawa and Tillaberi. Armed groups not only targeted and assassinated refugee leaders and host community leaders, but also they destroyed water pumps, water systems, and cell phone tower, which means they cut the ability of the communities, whether hosts or refugees, to communicate, but also having access to water, which, as you know, in the Sahel, is essential.
Some of these communities are really known for how hospitable, how welcoming they are to refugees or displaced people. Does that sometimes make them targets?
We're not aware of communities being targeted because of who they host. What we know is that civilians are targeted. Whether they are displaced or host community, they are the targets of those armed groups that are creating instability and insecurity. And that's what we need to look at. It is being able to make sure that those people being forced to flee are being provided with the assistance they need. And the assistance means shelter, food, water, and also access to health services and education for the children.
That was Romain Desclos, a spokesperson for UNHCR's West and Central Africa office. You are speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. Independent and exiled Burundian media institutions operating inside Rwanda say they were forced to shut down their operations. In an announcement made on Twitter on Wednesday, Renaissance TV, Radio RPA, and Nzamba Radio told their listeners that they were interrupting their programming effective March 24 for reasons beyond their control. Renaissance TV and Radio RPA were accused by the late President Pierre Nkurunziza's government of involvement in the 2015 alleged coup. Innocent Muhoozi, the exiled director of TV Renaissance, says Rwanda acted on behest of the Burundian government.
The outcome of the meeting we had today with officials of Rwanda is to tell us to stop our activities from Rwanda. And this because of the talks that are going on between the Burundian government and the Rwanda government. The Burundian government have been asking the Rwanda government to stop us from broadcasting from Rwanda. And the decision has been taken by the Rwanda authorities. And they notified us about that decision since this morning. And then we stopped our broadcasting from Rwanda.
Innocent, you have been broadcasting from Rwanda because you were forced or driven out of Burundi. Did the Rwandan government tell you that the discussions they are having with the Burundian government, do those discussions include your situation?
Yes, it's quite clear. It has been made quite clear, and we know about that since last October when we had the first meeting. And the Burundian government have been insisting since long time that the three medias, that means Radio Nzamba, Radio RPA, and the TV Renaissance, that those three medias should be stopped because they know the influence that we have in the country. So it's a permanent pressure that they are putting on the Rwanda government.
What is going to happen to you and the other Burundian broadcasters in Rwanda?
It seems like the decision concerns specifically these three medias because we were the ones working in Burundi before they targeted us and come shoot at our station, put fire on them, and still today they are policemen on our stations in Burundi. We don't have transmitters in Rwanda. We just work on the internet, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, websites. This is what we're doing from here. So what is going to be the next step is that we are going to try to find another way to do that, but out of Rwanda.
Has there been any follow-up? Because the new Burundian president, Evariste Ndayishimiye, has said that he was reaching out to, I think, exiled Burundians and the media. Has there been any follow-up since then?
Nothing has changed. The president has changed. So few members of the government have changed. But those who forced us to exile are still in that government. So when President Ndayishimiye said that, he shows some sign of possible dialogue, but I think it's just because of the talks they are having with the European Union to try to get the money back, the money that the European Union stopped giving the government. They are trying to show some sign that could mean that there is a kind of improvement, but we don't believe in any improvement. As long as the people who killed all those thousands of people who made all those crimes have become even more powerful in Burundi in 2015.
I'm interested, Innocent, what is the mainstay of your broadcast? What type of programming do you do?
Okay, the main programs we're doing today is information. Every evening we have two editions in Kirundi and in French. This is the case for TV Renaissance, for RPA, for Nzamba. We are all giving news every day, more or less 20 minutes of news in Kirundi and more or less 20 in French, and it's every day. And this, there is a lot of people in Burundi who follow those informations, the audio ones, on YouTube, on Facebook, on Twitter, on the website. So this is the problem they are having with us. They are witnessing the big influence that we are continue to have in the country, even if we are in exile.
Innocent, thank you so much. It's always nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, James. Thank you for everything.
Innocent Muhoozi is the exiled director of TV Renaissance. You are speaking with us from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. A spokesperson for Burundian President Evariste Ndayishimiye says Burundi does not need to put pressure on Rwanda or anyone to do what is the right thing to do. However, Willy Nyamitwe, chief of the Information and Communication Division at the Burundian State House, says Burundi welcomes Rwanda's decision to shut down exiled Burundian media institutions in Rwanda. After years of hostile relations between the two countries, Nyamitwe says shutting down what he calls hostile elements implies a new phase of normalizing Burundi-Rwanda relations.
Burundi does not need whatsoever to put pressure on anyone so that they can do what is right and what is just. Let us keep in mind that everything has a beginning, but also everything has an end. There has been a dark period over the relations between Burundi and Rwanda. Now we are entering a new phase of normalizing our relations. This implies that there are actions that must be taken in this direction. Therefore, what Rwanda has done in shutting down those rather bizarre medias falls within the logic of not allowing harmful elements to exist on its territory. Rwanda's gesture is highly appreciated.
Does this mean now that your government is willing for these journalists operating in Rwanda to return to Burundi, especially in line with President Ndayishimiye's pronouncement last year of dialoguing? Are you willing to dialogue with these journalists to return to Burundi?
Burundi belongs to all the Burundians, whoever they are, and whatever they have done in the past. And all the Burundians have the right to live in their country. President Evariste Ndayishimiye has invited all the refugees to come back home. Even those who have committed crimes should come back and be prosecuted according to the rule of law.
Willy Nyamitwe is the chief of the Information and Communications Division at the Burundian State House. He was speaking with us from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 25th. The World Food Program says it may be forced to cut food ration in June for more than a million vulnerable Somalis because it does not have enough money to maintain the operation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The clock is rapidly ticking to 2022. This is the date by which global leaders have committed to end tuberculosis. Data show that goal will be missed. Health officials agree the COVID-19 pandemic has dealt a heavy blow to global efforts to screen, diagnose, and provide early life-saving treatment to people with TB. Philippe Glazou, an epidemiologist in WHO's global TB program, says the pandemic has severely disrupted health and social systems, adversely affecting global TB control measures. He says data from 84 countries show an estimated 1.4 million people missed out on access to care in 2020.
Left untreated, TB results in about 50% case fatality. About half of the people who have TB, the disease, die from it if they are left untreated. More die from it if they have comorbidities, in particular HIV infection or undernutrition. And we've modeled that excess mortality to about 500,000 additional TB deaths.
Tuberculosis is the world's leading infectious cause of death, killing 1.4 million people annually. About 1.8 billion people, nearly a quarter of the global population, are infected with the bacteria that causes TB. The WHO estimates about 3 million people develop TB each year before the onset of COVID-19. The director of WHO's Global Tuberculosis Program, Teresa Kasayeva, says the pandemic has caused a significant drop in the number of people formerly diagnosed with TB, though not the actual number who developed the disease. She says the WHO fears more than 500,000 people may have died from TB in 2020 because they were unable to obtain a diagnosis.
Systematic screening should be scaled up to help reach all people with TB prevention and care. Systematic screening is critical to ensure we can detect TB early in the people who need it, while also identifying people who could benefit from TB preventive treatment.
The World Health Organization reports more than 20% fewer people now are receiving preventive care and treatment than in 2019. It says countries with the biggest comparative gaps include Indonesia, South Africa, the Philippines, and India. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe musicians have been struggling to maintain a living since the coronavirus pandemic prompted the government to ban concerts and other entertainment to prevent the spread of the virus. Some have even left their music behind and turned to farming. Columbus Mavunga reports from Mazowe, Zimbabwe.
Award-winning Zimbabwean singer Diana Samukange Nyazima frequently performed in her home country and across Africa, but not for the past year because of the coronavirus pandemic. No longer on stage or in the spotlight, she can be found instead at her farm in Mazowe district, about an hour's drive west of Harare. The coronavirus lockdowns stopped large gatherings and events like concerts, forcing Samukange Nyazima to look at other ways to make a living.
During the lockdown, I've learned one thing that I didn't know over the years. You never go wrong with agriculture. People always eat. People always want, you know, farm produce. That business for me is quite stable and it will bring income. And I now know that my money comes from the soil to also do other things, to boost my music business to work. So I found that there's more stability in agriculture at the moment, more than ukoko music side. But I'm not saying when given the two kutindi choose, I'm definitely going to be biased because I'm a musician. That defines who I am. I'm Diana who sings. So music is going to be my first love. But I need to survive.
The 32-year-old Afro-pop singer co-owns the farm with her husband, Calvin Nyazema. They are putting in irrigation pipes and also have set up beehives to collect eucalyptus honey from their 300,000 tree plantation. Zimbabwe's government recognizes the plight of musicians who have been unable to work because of the coronavirus lockdowns. Executive Director of Zimbabwe's National Arts Council, Nicholas Moyo, says he does not know when the ban on live performances will be lifted.
But we can say currently we are working on more of a stimulus package because we realize relief may never take us anywhere. But the government, through the Department of Social Welfare, continuously assists Zimbabweans that are in it.
But critics say lockdown relief payments of about $12 a month per family is not even enough to buy bread. Independent Harare-based economist John Robertson says authorities need to increase the financial support for those vulnerable.
So it really is up to you as an individual if you find yourself in difficulty. There's nobody going to come and help you, and there's certainly no officials. So you've got to be resourceful for your own sake. And you can bring in the rest of the family and say, let's work together and add to the income of the family with small things that each person can do. And the resourcefulness of the people of Zimbabwe has been absolutely amazing. And I think that that is going to continue to amaze us, even if COVID-19 lasts for a long time.
Singer Samukange Nyazima appears to be following that advice and plans to invest more in livestock if she gets funding. In the meantime, she has something else to sing about, a bountiful corn harvest expected on her farm in the coming weeks. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Mazowe, Zimbabwe.
And that's it for this Thursday, March 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.